Mission Roundhouse.
Hi there. You're listening to When Someone Great Is Gone, which is a podcast about death and grief, so it might not be suitable for everybody. We recommend that you go back and listen to episode 1 if you haven't already.
There is a beehive in the rafters of our house, and I can hear it all the time. It started off sounding a little bit like rain, and my boyfriend and I kept thinking that Stroud was this magical place where it only rained overnight, because we'd hear these scratchings and these little droplet sounds coming from the walls. But it turned into a bee's nest. I've become slightly fixated on this bee's nest, and sometimes I find myself putting my ear up against the wall just to listen to what they're doing. I think about the bee's nest a lot, and the scratches have turned into full-on buzzing. The walls have actually started to leak honey. I can't stop thinking about these bees, just all the time. And something that's actually quite delightful and isn't that annoying, apart from the fact I did get stung once, continues to be bothersome, and my brain just thinks about it when it should be thinking about other things. It's a literal buzz. I think it's evident that my brain works in a way where I become fixated on things. And this has been apparent for a while. This isn't anything new. And I remember being young and thinking a lot about death and thinking a lot about life and what it felt like to actually die in a way that wasn't necessarily what a normal kid would feel or do. And those tendencies have kind of been with me throughout my entire life. I am obsessed with death in a way that is sometimes quite alarming, but also has become normalized to myself. If I have so much as a small ailment, or God, the worst anecdote is when I got my ears pierced and I could not stop thinking about it, to the point where I drove my own body to go bright red over something so small because I was so worried about the fact that I had a wound, even though it was tiny. Just continuously thinking about mortality and worrying about an ailment,
not just for myself, but for other people, has been such a fixture in my existence.
I mean, one day it's bees,
one day it's cancer,
one day it's, did I send a text 3 days ago that is going to haunt me for the rest of my life? My Google search history is awful.
October the 12th, 2019.
Searched for mouth cancer symptoms.
Searched again for mouth cancer symptoms.
Photo.
Visited.
What does June mouth 30th, look like?
Visited the same website 3 times within 10 minutes.
Searched lung cancer.
Cervical cancer symptoms.
Is it lung cancer?
Early stage mouth cancer.
I smoke 5 cigarettes a month. Is it lung
searched
cancer?
Searched for mouth cancer again. And searched for mouth cancer
visited,
again.
Visited. This is why coffee makes you
visited,
anxious.
Visited number of coronavirus cases and risk
visited
in the UK.
Songs about death.
Searched for the top 5 regrets of the dying. What does it feel like to die?
These obsessions are really bizarre, but they kind of make sense because something really bad happened to our family when I was young.
I'm going to be introducing this, a memorial and a celebration of Kate's life. So on behalf of Sue and on behalf of Dan and on behalf of Izzy, welcome to this celebration.
I thought we couldn't get through today really without talking about Kate's illness because it has been a watershed in her life and a lot of ours. In November 1996, Kate was diagnosed with cancer of the esophagus. We moved into what Angela Carter describes as a pessimism of the intellect and an optimism of the spirit in order to get through this period. One night I came home from work to find Isabel, then 3, hysterical. Kate had been sent home from tests with no prior warning and told, as she left, not to touch small children or pregnant women because of residual radiation. She was bravely refusing to hold Isabel. Afterwards, we joked about radioactive mum, but the thoughtlessness of the whole episode left a rather bitter taste.
I guess I've grown up with this idea of death and grown up with this idea of illness. And my worry about cancer and how it will affect me, my friends, my family, is something that will stick with me for the rest of my life. And I guess I have to live with it and work through it, and my friends and family understand that too. Maybe actually having something like the bees to concentrate on right now over the worry of, you know, illness, especially because it's so escalated and emphasised by what's going on with COVID-19, isn't necessarily a bad thing. You know, we're seeing accounts of death and illness every day in the press, and I know I'm not alone in being worried by that. Obsessive thoughts don't discriminate and they take over your brain, and sometimes I find myself just expecting to die in the following day. It helps having doctor friends to ring up and assure me that it's okay, but also to try and dissuade me from indulging in it too much. This is one of my best friends, Rose.
See, I think sometimes you can... like, obviously, you send your message and you say, oh, I'm really worried about this thing. So the earrings one is a really good example. Like, I can tell whenever you're feeling a bit more anxious than normal or whatever, you will always say, I think my earring's infected again, or God, it looks so bad. And then you send me a photo and you're like, it looks horrific, doesn't it? And I look at the photo and I think, okay, it looks slightly red. But yeah, it looks like it's going to be fine. But I think you do keep quite down to earth, even when you're sending those messages. As soon as I say, yeah, it looks a bit sore, but, you know, you don't need to go to the doctors, you don't need to go and get your ear chopped off or anything, then you do accept that quite quickly. And then you, throughout it, you're still able, you keep your sense of humour and you're able to laugh about it together with me. So, yeah, it's definitely an indicator of that I notice when you're feeling more anxious and things. So it's a hint to me to just check in with you and check everything's okay a bit more. Yeah, I'm glad that we can get the humour out of it as well.
There's something going on inside my brain. I'm older, but I'm still just as insane. 'Cause my brain is not.
I've never been afraid to personally express these feelings of health anxiety and worry in any of my music and my creative work. And I've written songs on what it feels like to be trapped in this vicious circle of constantly worrying about unhealthy notions of being unhealthy, and also my brain just not stopping thinking about a certain negative or horrible subject. But I think creativity is a great way of expressing these emotions and having a grasp on them.
Maybe I should start talking to someone. Get a little fresh air outside. Maybe I should be more patient with me. 'Cause there's
But you know, it is also okay not to be okay. Unfortunately, because Kate did die from terminal illness, cancer, my memories of her do show her deteriorating. And when you're young and are exposed to someone going through that illness, it's hard not to think of them as being ill. And I remember one memory of her when we were watching Wimbledon in bed together, when I was really little, and even at that age I could put my hands around her wrists, and that's one of my strongest memories of her. I think that deterioration does affect my memory of her, and perhaps connects to this issue of my own health anxiety. But also I remember how important it was to talk through her illness and to have a community around it, both personal and professional. And this professional network is no different today. And professionals can really help families going through someone dying from terminal illness and facilitating important end-of-life care.
My name's Claire. I'm a spiritual care coordinator at a hospice in Cardiff. My job is a modern interpretation of a traditional chaplain role. So I work on an inpatient unit which has 28 beds, which are palliative care beds, and I help to support people to meet or fulfil their religious or spiritual expression during their end-of-life care. I spend a lot of time working with patients and also their families on making sense and coming to terms with the situation, but also putting meaning around it. So for some people that can be very positive, that can be something that is in the pursuit of peace and understanding that life has an end, and that is very a natural process that we're facilitating. And for some people that's making sense of the pain and suffering that is coming with the deaths. My role is to serve people of all faiths and none, people who would be important to someone at the end of their life. So, for example, if someone was a Catholic and they wanted to have last rites from a priest, it would be my job to coordinate that and also then just let the nurses know that that's happening. But also it might just be that someone maybe would feel that the soul is something that's tangible, but that's not necessarily related to a religious belief, but they would like it to be known that they want the window open after they've died so that their soul can leave their body. So I guess the thing that I always say to families, particularly in the immediate aftermath of a death, would be that when we grieve, we have to grieve separately and together, particularly if you're in a family unit. So as an individual, you will need to come to your own journey of grief that has its own meaning and perhaps markers, but collectively as a unit or a network or a family, you will need to memorialise what has happened and that individual. People are more likely to have a positive grief outcome if they have had conversations about what life would be like without the other person there, whether that's with your spouse, can I get married again? Or is that, do you want to be cremated or buried? And do you want people to wear black or flowers at your funeral? And I think that those conversations can be formal and quite specific, but I think they can also be casual and still very helpful. And I think that it's a real gift if you have communicated what you want and need to the people around you so that they can look back and know I did what they would have wanted. And so I always say to people who are planning funerals or getting their affairs in order, I say this is a real kindness that you are giving to your family because you are taking away the stress and the worry of the practical side of things.
I also spoke to Claire about contextualising her professional work during the COVID-19 crisis.
Although the deaths technically wouldn't really be defined as sudden because most of the time we've got some sort of a diagnosis or someone perhaps is in hospital or they've certainly had symptoms and been unwell in the lead up to a death. They are taking on a nature that comes across as sudden because perhaps if you had someone who was ill in your family or your friendship group, you would visit them and you would notice that they were changing. And so you would perhaps be able to prepare, whether that was consciously or unconsciously, for the fact that those changes would continue to increase and they would deteriorate further. But because people are not able to see their loved ones, they don't have that those visual clues, those determining changes with which to say, I can see where this is going. And I think that is also really challenging for people, that the reality is that for many, the last time they saw someone, they were fit and well, and now they aren't with us anymore because of the virus, feels very, it doesn't feel real, does it? It doesn't sound real, does it? It sounds very intangible.
Feelings of grief are always hard to navigate. I spoke with the poet Fahad Al-Amoudi about how his creativity has helped him to deal with loss.
I suffer from an anxiety disorder and depression as a result of complex grief. So in that way, grief can be quite a physical reaction or quite a physical response. My name is Fahad. I'm a poet, and this is a poem I'm working on. My mother is a half-abandoned house. There were no summers, just fault lines cut across clouds bleeding a sun that set fire to the path, rich terracotta, blood of the earth, a tongue unfurled, trod over by wandering feet, the scars of a diaspora. Mum spoke in sharp tones, a protruding nail, a slam door hanging off its hinges like a carcass, the way her coat hung on the peg under candlelight. Power cuts, floating faces in the dark, shadows of a boy painted the walls. Crimson-lined living room. Granddad melted into the corner like a forgotten red wine stain. Smoke and soil and it's a small world after all, wafted through the air. And I walk blind, deaf, bleeding under cracked ceilings I mistook for smiles. Mum taught me parcel tongue, so I became gardener fighting vines and ivy coiled around the walls like veins. I could not stop them dragging the house down. The house exists in song, in splinters and coat hangers, a wooden beam raised out the ground. Home is a favour, so I rent the house in dreams, behind my eyelids. Peeling plaster falls to the earth like ash, gives breath to the dawn. My mum called me into her room one day. She was watching old videos of us in Ethiopia. And I was just a little baby. And in the video, there was my mum, grandma, granddad, and some other people who I can't remember. But I remember I was crying in the video. And I just remember the look on my mum's face as she was watching and her asking me, "Are you happy?" If I could describe in one word, she was fierce. You wouldn't want to cross her. But in a loving sense, you know, she cared about her family. I think in some ways she was the linchpin of her family. She held everything together. She helped support everyone. And she was an incredibly strong woman. And it was just me and my mother at the time. So I was essentially brought up in a single parent household until the age of 8 when she passed away. My relationship with my mother when she was alive was very complicated, so I try and keep as much a balanced a memory as I possibly can. It is quite sad, and it does get me down sometimes, but I often remember more the negative than I do the positive. I think that's part of the nature of what our relationship was like. My mum was, as far as I know, born in a place called Shashamani in Ethiopia, which is a really cool place. Well, cool and not cool. Cool because the city itself was created by Haile Selassie for Rastafarian immigrants from the Caribbean. So it's a wonderful piece of history to be involved in. Not cool because it wasn't a great place. but she was born there. She grew up in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. And she moved to London, I want to say in the early 90s, but it could have been late 80s. She was married first before she met my dad. Unfortunately, her partner passed away. And then she met my dad and then I was born. She was... My mum was... I don't know if it's a generational thing or if it's... It's hard to describe. And to put it simply, my mum was desperate to be white. So my mum thought that whiteness and Englishness was the pinnacle of success and intellect and culture. So she was adamant that I was to speak the best English possible and that I was to sort of forget any connection I had with my African identity. And it was quite sad to see. Although I understood where it come from, the context of why she moved and what was going on in Ethiopia at the time. And obviously, we are constantly exposed to ideas that Africanness and blackness is inferior. So I understand that, but obviously it was quite sad because I then had to do a lot of, work, I guess, to understand who I was and where I came from. A very strange dichotomy because we would go every holiday. So every single time I was not in school, we would be in Ethiopia. And I was encouraged to engage in the culture and all that. And yet there was just this other side where it was like, she would only speak English to me. No Amharic, no Tigrinya, no Oromia, nothing. And it was really weird. And then I'd be chastised for not speaking these languages and not eating injera and having the coffee, even though I was 5 years old. And yet, you know, you have to be English fad, you are British fad, you know, above all. So it was really strange and confusing.
I watch his eyes dart around the room, pendulum, pupils, black body swinging from the trees in Shashamani Ras. Ras, Ras, a room full of Tafari speaking the king's English, but auntie still lashes me with my mother tongue. I wear the scars like my uncle's suit. Custom built tailor fit survivor's guilt silky spins a web of laughter from it. I'm lost in his sticky sin, swimming around the story threads that dance around his cocooned heart. I wash up on the shore next to Dad. When I ask him what happened to his friends who never left, his head drops. It sounds like they're snapping necks. I can see them in the trenches of his forehead. His shadow looks like their bodies.
How do you think that loss has shaped your life so far?
In the immediate aftermath, I think it made me quite a serious person, perhaps maybe more reserved than I was before. I didn't speak as much. And I think that I sort of adopted this kind of one-track mind mentality a little bit. I had more of a determination to do things, maybe more of a focus, and I try and take myself a little less seriously. I've made more of an effort to do that as the years have gone on, as friends have been like, stop being such a judgmental prick. But yeah, I think, yeah, those are the enduring legacies.
In terms of that determination, is that with your work and your studies? And
it immediately came through in that. From the first poem I wrote at God, 10 years old, maybe.
Do you think loss inspired any of your writing?
I didn't think so at the time. I wanted to do everything, right? I wanted to write film, TV, just everything. I wrote like little terrible scripts. And when I left secondary school, I dug some of them up. And I was like, oh my God, I had no clue that actually what I was writing about was me processing this loss.
I think it'd be really interesting to also talk about your influences and which writers influence you and your work currently.
In the world of poetry, I'm a huge fan of Kaya Chingani, who I have the privilege of being a lecturer at my university, Nick McCullough. When I read Kingdom of Gravity, that was the first, like, eureka moment I'd ever had reading poetry. I was like, okay, I can connect with this guy in a way that I've never connected to any other writer before. I feel like his voice and my voice are in some way connected. It was just like a holy crap moment for me.
That made me think about kind of other cultural art forms and whether that also influences your writing as well.
Yeah, I was hugely influenced by hip hop. Some of my favorite writers, Kendrick, Andre 3000, mm-hmm. MF Doom. I mean, MF Doom basically taught me how to rhyme, in all honesty.
I love when there's a cross arts crossover as well.
That's where the best things come from. I mean, you sit and talk to most accomplished poets, and what they consume in order to come out with what they produce, like, it's just so varied and diverse across mm-hmm. everything, whether it's plays, whether it's short stories, it could be anything.
in its current form and also in its previous form, what do you think grief looks like to you? Do you think it's part of the poetry that you've written? Obviously, you've said that, or creativity, or do you think there's other elements to it?
I suffer from an anxiety disorder and depression as a result of complex grief. So in that way, grief can be quite a physical reaction or quite a physical response. But it also does inform the content of my writing as well. I don't think grief looks like anything. I think in the popular imagination, there are images of grief that maybe aren't particularly helpful for understanding how it affects people differently.
Yeah.
You know, I can only speak from a personal experience. So I can say that, you know, that grief is a physical experience for me. Or physiological experience, I guess, is probably a better term. But I can't speak for everyone.
That's really interesting that you say that it's a physiological experience, because I'm the exact same and I've never spoken to anyone that's had that.
Really?
No. When you said that, part of me just felt that wrench within me of that kind of anxiety that's explored.
And it comes at the most random times, right?
So random. Yeah. I have this awful thing where if I think about death, like I'm obsessed with death. Obsessed with death.
Yeah.
I am obsessed with it in a scientific and analytical way, in an emotional way, in any format. I'll be walking along the street sometimes and I'll be like, oh, I could die in front of that bus right now. Yeah. Childhood trauma, yeah. 101. And also in terms of a more emotional aspect and how it affects me physically, if I think about my mother's death and seeing her deteriorate, I start to think, oh, I must be deteriorating. She died from cancer. I've probably got cancer. And then you go into a horrible cycle of thinking that one tiny thing that's wrong with you is going to basically destroy you.
Yeah. No, that's freaky, because I relate to that. But yeah, fascination with death, 100%, in every sense, in a very like corporeal sense, in all art, I'm fascinated by the themes that explore death.
Yeah.
In comedy, it's just, you can ponder over it endlessly and you'll never get an answer. I thought, see everything as, even like political systems and human relations with each other, as a way of coping with the idea that we're all mortal.
But then when you're exposed to it very young, you can't process it in the same way, right? So I feel like you spend your whole life pondering why you never understood it.
Yeah, and then torture yourself by reading things or like watching things.
Obviously, we've both discussed what grief can... Well, grief doesn't really look like something, but what grief can feel like. And it's definitely not prescriptive. We understand that. But in terms of the physiological aspects, how have you coped with that or are trying to cope with that?
Therapy. Therapy and distractions. Two things that I owe to actually dealing with it. I refused to accept it for a long time, despite how obvious it was. Again, it's never really obvious to you, though, I guess. But for a long time I ignored it, and then finally sought help from a psychologist, and been in therapy for just over a year, I'd say, like 14-ish
wow.
months. And in that year, yeah, I feel like I have the tools to start dealing with the physiological side of it, which has been really helpful. And then distractions. I mean, even basic things like playing video games.
I guess, like you, I really love every kind of art form. I have a favourite art form. For me, it's music. But that distraction through art is really important as well, because I think when you've experienced grief or trauma, one of the beautiful things to come out of it, obviously, is art. And appreciation of art, I think, sometimes gets amplified because you realise that there is beauty in life despite seeing an ugly side to it.
100%. Yeah.
Yeah. Even with video games.
Video games are art. I don't care what anyone says. Like, find me. Also, people, actually, now that you sort of mentioned that, I've just remembered people can be a really good way of dealing with it. But the right people. So I'm in a band, and the two people that I'm in that band with are musicians, and they're great people. And being around music and people that, you know, that you can be intimate with and you can have a great time with, it's a really healthy mix of all those things.
and a form of kind of understanding on a personal level, but also expression as a collective level.
Mm. I'm just so fascinated about what you can do with poetry that I want to explore as much of that as I can.
That sounds like a good idea.
I hope so.
Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
That was episode 2 of When Someone Great Is Gone, featuring Fahad, a poet based in London and the North East, with music from his band, The Poetry Experiment, and additional music from my band, Sime. When Someone Great Is Gone is a podcast powered by Transmission Roundhouse, hosted and produced by Izzy Lee Poulton, and co-produced by Bridie Addison Child. A special thanks to James Tyndall for additional editing on the podcast, and Marie and Nikki from the Roundhouse for facilitating this project. Yeah.